Hello. Today I'm going to cover part two in this series on tax court. This will be the final of the two parts because there is no way I can cover everything with tax court. But today I'm going to discuss in more depth what a pretrial memo and a stipulation of facts, what those documents are. I will talk to you about the calendar call, go over tax litigation, some highlights of trial, talk to you about qualified offers and the Cohan rule.
Welcome to Tax Justice Warriors, the podcast that celebrates the work of low-income taxpayer clinics, focuses on tax controversy work, and looks at related issues in tax news. I'm your host, William Schmidt, the director of the Low-Income Taxpayer Clinic at Kansas Legal Services.
Last episode, I spoke about the pretrial memo and the stipulation of fact. I touched on those a little bit, but I am going to speak to you in more depth today on what those documents entail. The pretrial memorandum lists the information for the judge so the judge will understand just what is happening in the case, putting on there where the location for the trial is, the date for the trial, the name of the case, so the petitioner or petitioners and the docket number, the attorneys for petitioner and respondent, including their telephone numbers, the amounts in dispute, so the years and deficiencies, the status of the case, whether there would be a settlement, a probable trial, or a definite trial, the current estimate of trial time, such as 1 hour, motions that your side expects to make, the status of the stipulation of facts, whether that is completed or in process, the issues at trial, the witnesses your side expects to call, summary of the fact, and this would be from your side, a brief synopsis of legal authorities and evidentiary problems anticipated. This document is a legal court document, so it would have a certificate of service attached. And that is generally what would be listed in the pretrial memorandum. Next, I'm going to the stipulation of fact. And the stipulation of facts is a joint document between both parties, between the petitioner or petitioners and the IRS. These are stipulations that both parties agree on, so that would be presented in this document to the judge, basically saying these are facts that are not at issue between the parties, so we are skipping any argument on these specific facts, and what else is at issue, that is what would be discussed at trial in litigation. So some examples of what would be in the stipulation of facts, and I am reading from a fictional example. So the first stipulation are that petitioners George and Martha Washington had a mailing address of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. at the time the petition was filed. The petitioners timely filed a U.S. individual income tax return for tax year 2006. A copy of the tax return for tax year 2006 is attached as Exhibit 1J. Respondent sent a statutory notice of deficiency to petitioner on July 4, 2007, setting forth a deficiency in income tax in the amount of $4,000 for tax year 2006. A copy of the notice of deficiency for tax year 2006 is attached as Exhibit 2J. In the notice of deficiency, respondent asserted an increase in petitioner's 2006 income tax resulting from discharge of indebtedness in the amount of $15,000. A copy of the notice of deficiency is attached as Exhibit 3J. Petitioner's light truck had a fair market value of $15,000 on July 3 and August 1 of 2006. A copy of petitioner's bankruptcy schedules for case number 9876-06 is attached as Exhibit 4J. The parties would sign the stipulation of fact and submit them to the judge. Generally, all documentary evidence has to be exchanged 15 days before trial. Notice of witnesses and exhibits also needs to be exchanged in that 15 days before trial. That is generally the standing order from the tax court regarding pretrial, but there may be other orders that come from the judge specifically for a case. Now, next I'm going to speak to you about calendar call. Often the calendar call is set up for a Monday morning, though the first day of tax court may be scheduled on a different day in a particular city. The first day of tax court within the city is the calendar call. So all of the parties are on notice about the calendar call, and unless a trial has already been scheduled, those parties need to be appearing for the calendar call on the first day of court for that session. The clerk will go down the line calling the petitioner scheduled on the docket. Those parties that have not settled should be there. When the first petitioner is called that has not settled or been scheduled for trial, when that case is called, then it is up to the petitioner to be present. If the petitioner is not present, the IRS will be the only party appearing, and the judge will ask the IRS what the status of the case is. If the petitioner has not appeared, then the judge may either dismiss the case. The IRS would move to dismiss the case, but it also may be on lack of prosecution of any action by the petitioner, so that is the reason to dismiss the case. The judge also has the ability to take the case under advisement, potentially giving the petitioner until the end of the court session the time that the judge is in town, basically, for the petitioner to appear or to contact the court with reasoning why the petitioner has not appeared or potentially make the case for the petitioner. Now, assuming the petitioner has appeared, then both parties will appear before the judge. The petitioner may be stating their case, basically saying whether they are ready to go to trial or to settle. If settling, then they make arrangements. Perhaps the settlement documents are due within the next couple weeks to the tax court. If there is going to be a trial, then the judge will schedule the trial, and that may be that day or within the next couple days, depending on how much time the judge is in the city for tax court. Now, also, the low-income taxpayer clinics and various bar associations, various pro bono attorneys may appear at the tax court to be providing pro bono assistance for unrepresented petitioners at tax court. Generally, the judges are allowing the volunteer attorneys to be providing free consultations for those unrepresented petitioners. If one of the clinics or attorneys is agreeing to represent the petitioner, then that is a discussion with the IRS attorney, with the judge, whether the attorney is going to enter an appearance or provide other assistance. That may be a discussion between the judge with the IRS to see what would be most agreeable between the parties. If tax court is not going to be in the city for several months to a year, then that is certainly a consideration on whether there would be a continuance or not. Certainly the judge would have a preference of seeing a timely resolution for the case, but certainly wants to make sure that the petitioner is represented as best he or she is able to be represented. Now, next, I was going to talk to you a little bit about the Villanova Tax Litigation Course. This is at Villanova University School of Law in Pennsylvania. I took a course in May 2016 from David Breen and Ron Collins. Both of those individuals had or have experience working with the IRS as counsel. They both have experience in tax litigation, so I certainly recommend the course. The course is offered at a discount for low-income taxpayer clinic employees, so certainly if you live within driving distance of Philadelphia, it would certainly be worth checking to see if the course is available. Now, I believe David Breen may have been fully retiring, so I don't know the status of the course at this point, but certainly each May, it would be worth checking to see if that course is offered through the Villanova Law School. I wanted to talk to you a bit about some of what I had learned. but there is no way to summarize litigation within 10 to 15 minutes. I'm just going to hit on some highlights, but there is no way to discuss everything about litigation that a person would need to know. I would certainly recommend, if you're going to be involved in heavy litigation, to get training. I recommend the National Institute for Trial Advocacy. There may be courses offered by bar associations or law schools. There are texts out there, or you may be able to find information online, but I recommend learning about trial advocacy if you are going to be involved in tax litigation. When I took the Villanova tax litigation course, I had taken a trial advocacy course during my regular law school, so to some degree, the course was a refresher, but I certainly recommend a tax litigation course like this. It always helps to take a refresher, but it is good to think about what a person needs to know about tax litigation, especially when dealing with tax court. To begin with, the rules of evidence are the federal rules of evidence as applied in Washington, D.C. That is what used to be applied, but now the federal rules of evidence are as applied under the circuit that you are in. So the various circuit courts through the United States, those can be looked up online. Specifically, various regions are under different circuits. So within the tax litigation course, they recommended 5 minutes for opening statements, possibly as long as 10, but they generally were saying 5 minutes and not to make closing statements. We covered a variety of steps within tax litigation, such as the steps for offering documents or otherwise offering evidence. The stipulations, for example, are agreed exhibits that would be marked beginning with 1J, offered to evidence, 2 copies of the stipulations for evidence. Evidence offered by the petitioner should be marked with a P, but the respondent should be marked R, and like I was saying, anything offered jointly should be marked with a J. We discussed various pieces at trial, such as hearsay and exceptions to hearsay, cross-examination, refreshing the recollection of the witness, impeaching a witness, direct examination, motions and objections, formal discovery. Those are interrogatories, requests for production of documents, and depositions. Those are generally used sparingly in tax court. Formal discovery is interrogatories under Tax Court Rule 71, request for production of documents under Tax Court Rule 72. A request for admissions is technically not discovery, but it is extremely close and generally treated as discovery. And depositions, those are common in the outside world, but not tax court. Those are under Tax Court Rule 74. They are generally more useful for the government, the IRS, than for the taxpayer. Generally, discovery is informal within tax court. So basically, each party would be asking for discovery items, but eventually you can get to motions to compel or motions for sanctions if the other party isn't complying with discovery requests. Next, I wanted to talk to you about a qualified offer. This is an offer by the taxpayer, the petitioner, on specific terms to settle a case. It allows a taxpayer to collect fees from the government. The qualified offer is under Internal Revenue Code Section 7430. In any administrative or court case brought against the United States, Section 7430 allows a taxpayer to recover reasonable administrative and litigation costs, provided the costs are associated with the determination, the taxpayer exhausted their administrative remedies, the costs incurred by the taxpayer are only associated with the United States and not another third party, the taxpayer did not protract the proceeding, and the taxpayer is a prevailing party. The prevailing party means that the taxpayer is required under Section 7430A to establish that he or she is a prevailing party to recover costs and fees. In order to establish this, the taxpayer must prove that he or she substantially prevailed in the proceeding with respect to the amount in controversy or the most significant issues. The taxpayer met the net worth requirements of Section 7430C4A. The government does not establish that its position was substantially justified. However, where a taxpayer makes a qualified offer that the IRS rejects and later wins a determination to pay less than the amount they had offered, the taxpayer will be considered to be the prevailing party. Qualified offer is an offer meeting the following criteria. The offer is written. The offer is made by the taxpayer to the IRS during the qualified offer period. The offer specifies the amount of the taxpayer's liability. The offer is designated as a qualified offer under Section 7430G, and the offer remains open from the date it is made until the earlier of the following. A. The offer is rejected. B. The date the trial begins. Or C. The 90th day after the offer is made. The qualified offer period. The offer is required to be made during the qualified offer period, which is the period of time that starts on the date of the proposed deficiency, which allows the taxpayer an opportunity for administrative review with the IRS Office of Appeals, and ends on the date which is 30 days before the trial is set to begin. So this can increase the pressure on the government to go forward only with cases where they're likely to prevail. It creates the potential to recover fees after the case is resolved, and it adds no additional risk for the taxpayer. Lastly, I wanted to mention the Cohan rule. The Cohan rule is based on a previous tax court case, Cohan, regarding the evidence for the petitioner regarding specific financial matters. The quality of that evidence may have degraded, and the court will apply the average to the months, so the IRS will also allow that. What this means is that a petitioner may not specifically have evidence for everything to support their finances, and they can request under the Cohan rule. The IRS will also follow that, but this may allow for 2 months of rent payments without any documentation, but it will not get you very far, such as travel expenses or something else, because the regulatory requirements will trump the Cohan rule. A person is not going to get out of Internal Revenue Code requirements regarding financial documents under the Cohan rule, but it may be a possible substitute to some degree if the petitioner does not have all of their financial documents in order to present as evidence. Hopefully this gave you some extra information on tax court. I hope all of this will help you. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to Tax Justice Warriors. We have a Patreon page if you'd like to support this podcast. Providing monetary support for this podcast helps with expenses like equipment or travel to tax conferences. Supporting this podcast through Patreon comes with rewards, so check out our Patreon page. Please rate or review this podcast because positive reviews help get more people to know this podcast exists. The views expressed on this podcast are not official opinions of the IRS, the Low Income Taxpayer Clinic program, or the employers of the people who spoke on this program. Your tax situation is unique, so do not take the statements on this program as tax or legal advice. Consult with your own tax professional to provide you with specific advice on your situation. Tune in next time on Tax Justice Warriors for another interesting tax discussion.